From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is my current affairs colleague, Rick Pantaleo, host of the science edition of Press Conference USA and VOA's Science in a Minute. On this edition of the program, Mark Bryan, senior foresight consultant at the Future Today Institute, joins us for our annual conversation about the future of technology and its implications for business, society, and politics. Mark works with the Institute's clients on understanding and addressing the future of their businesses or industries or any relevant topic that may be of interest to them. He conducts research to create possible scenarios that demonstrate ways their clients can compete and have impact and success that can be used for strategic planning and decision making. Mark also contributes to the Institute's annual Tech Trend Report, focusing on the report's supply chain and logistics industry book. The Future Today Institute is a leading future forecasting firm now in its second decade. Founded by Amy Webb in 2006, the Future Today Institute focuses on how emerging technology and science will disrupt business, transform the workforce, and ignite geopolitical change. Well, speaking of geopolitical change, among the issues we'll examine today are how Russia is weaponizing gas and other resources due to its invasion of Ukraine. And while many consider that the COVID-19 pandemic is winding down, it still continued to be a major disruptor throughout the world in 2022. Mark will talk with us about the technology trends that shaped 2022 and what we can expect in 2023 and beyond. And he joins us today via Zoom. Mark Bryan, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And it's always a delight to welcome my colleague, Rick Pantaleo. Welcome to you, Rick.
Thanks, Carol.
So, Mark, before we get into the trends for 2023, let's take a quick look at what happened in 2022. What, in your view, Mark, were the major or most significant technological, scientific, business, and geostrategic trends that dominated in 2022?
Well, I think unsurprisingly, AI has become one of the dominant technological trends with the rise of ChatGPT, which just passed the Turing test. We see fusion power becoming more of a reality. We also see what happened during the midterm elections in the United States, where a lot of people were turning once again to social media for their news resources. And we also saw a lot of new technology come into play within our climate change concerns, whether that's green energy with our clean grid infrastructure, as well as then things like social media changing because of Twitter. So everything, I think in 2021, the word that I probably would have used was authenticity. And I think what everybody is starting to shift towards in 2022, and then maybe even 2023, is this idea of trust and how we can trust one another, how we can trust our news and media and democracy, how we can trust our technology too, especially with the rise of AI becoming more pervasive throughout the world, throughout our businesses.
Mark, a few weeks ago for my science edition of Press Conference USA, I spoke with Matthew Canterman, director of research at Ball Metaverse Research, about the emergence of the metaverse. How do you see the metaverse making its way into our daily lives? And how soon do you see it becoming usably developed and ready for use?
Well, it's interesting because I think everybody has high hopes for the metaverse. And I do too, quite frankly. I think there is great opportunity for it. I think when we talk about the metaverse, we have to be very careful because it can be accessed through a number of different ways, whether that's through a VR headset, whether that is through a gaming console, whether that's through your computer, your phone. And so the dispersal of the metaverse is something that is making more accessible, which is great. We want everybody to have access to technology, but making sure that people have the equitable access is also problematic too. We don't want to develop the metaverse in a way that creates another haves and have nots situation. My personal stance on the metaverse is that it does offer opportunities for exploration, specifically people who are on the neurodiverse spectrum, who may have trouble getting out into society, being able to experience something in the metaverse that they may not be able to do in the real world. It also offers up new ways for travel, for pre-experiencing travel. So I think the one thing to be aware of is that I don't think anybody really wants to live in the metaverse 24/7, at least not with the current technology that we have. Having a headset on for many, many hours causes issues. There's studies that show that people have dizziness, they have other just stability issues with that. The other thing that's really interesting when it comes to the metaverse is that I've heard both anecdotally and through some research that people who use the metaverse are actually, they lose their sense of time. They are actually saying that what they thought was 15 minutes, it actually was something like, I think, 20 minutes. So it's a general increase of time. So we need to be thinking about how we can make sure that everybody has access. We need to be making sure that the experiences that are designed in there are taken into account some of those other cognitive disabilities, and making sure that we are still constantly thinking about new technology ways to experience it. So I think that we're going to see more developments in 2023 with the metaverse, but I don't think that it's going to become as predominant. Maybe in the next 3 to 5 years, as technology maybe becomes more pervasive, as some of our screens start to change, things like that would make it more adoptable for everybody.
Mark, you referred to ChatGPT. So I'd like you to expound upon what ChatGPT is and its implications for news media.
ChatGPT is an AI program. So it was developed by OpenAI, which is a research institute that is actually looking to develop AI in a responsible way. So they've developed GPT-2, GPT-3. And so ChatGPT is the next evolution of GPT. So GPT is a natural language processing language model that learns from the data that's online in order to be able to give a response. So somebody would put in a question, prompt, and then GPT would be able to provide the response to them. So up to this point, GPT would give a response that was slightly mechanical, that was perfunctory, and probably would just give the basics if it had an answer at all. And the thing that you should recognize is that there's still biases that are part of this because it's learning from information that's on the internet. So the group, OpenAI, is still having a lot to go through and moderate. So ChatGPT is, in essence, a chatbot version of it. It was designed to be more conversational than GPT-3. It actually has many more parameters, which are the weights that help understand the information that it's processing. So previously, it had a couple billion parameters, and now it's got 175 billion parameters that allow it to know how to respond. So now you could even ask ChatGPT to write you a poem, perhaps in the style of your favorite author. It's been known to help write code. Now, with that being said, again, it's not perfect. And this is where we really need to be careful about thinking that all of a sudden programs like this are going to just take over news media. Well, I will say that news groups like the Associated Press have been using AI and automation in order to automate some of their journalism with things like some of their earning reports and sports reports. We still need human interaction to supervise what ChatGPT and other language models are going to be able to do for news media. So while it can help write a story, again, you're still going to need an editor to be able to go through it and to review it. This is where I think the idea of prompters is going to become much more important. We're going to see that skill set start to really become more discussed and something that could be done through training that would allow people to become prompters in a much more meaningful way. It's something that we're seeing with Midjourney. You're having individuals, they're becoming better at being able to say what prompt to put into it, what words, what set of words or key questions and phrases that would produce the outcomes they're looking for. So there's still a lot of regulation that needs to happen. There's many different AI acts and regulations that are coming out. We just saw China put out a watermark requirement. It was put out by China's Office of Central Cyberspace Affairs Commission. And it was done so that they could help recognize what content had been AI generated. And they're doing it in a way to say that they're hoping that this will help with users to be able to assess which media to consume and to understand that if it's got this watermark, it's gone through certain compliances, which is really about trust. So again, I think 2023, we're going to be talking a lot more about trust.
ChatGPT, that reminds me of another trend that people have been warning about, and that's deep fakes. Do you see that being a continued problem in the coming year and beyond?
So deep fakes are, I think, with anything, we've got content. I think we've got bad actors that are always going to try to break things. They're always going to try to see if they can take a program and corrupt it. I mean, that's what we saw with earlier AI models like Tay AI, where it was unleashed on Twitter and Twitter turned it into something that it was unintended to be. So I think, yes, deepfakes are going to become a continued concern. I think with these language models that are able to pass the Turing test that shows that it can feel like you're talking to a human, whether or not we want to have a conversation on whether the Turing test is actually about measuring intelligence or humanity is a different conversation, I think. But I think, you know, we're starting to see these deepfakes become something that were intended for maybe even an artificial news anchor become something that in its essence becomes its own bad actor. There was Little Michaela, which was intended to be a completely virtual influencer. And now you have those deepfakes that can sell you products that are not healthy, not good for you, or not even correct.
Mark, before we take a break, let me ask you about something fascinating that is in one of your reports. Digital IDs will become more and more apparent that they will start to outpace physical ID use. And this was in 2022. Do you see that continuing this year?
I do. I think what's been really interesting to watch, not from a personal ID standpoint, but digital passports from a product and material standpoint, where we're seeing companies, due to their ESG policies, they're investigating the production and manufacturing of their products down to the granular level, where they're going to their procurement sources and asking them about their processes. And then they're documenting that and they're taking that data and they're putting it onto these digital passports so that as they go through customs, they can demonstrate where they were made, where they made, making sure they were avoiding forced labor, where they made using sustainable practices, where they made using plastics that they should not be using, where they made using other bad materials. So I think this idea of a digital ID is expanding even into the product realm that we're going to be experiencing into 2023.
Let's take a short break. You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Science Edition host Rick Pantaleo. Our guest is Mark Bryan. He's Senior Foresight Consultant at the Future Today Institute, joining us for our annual conversation about the future of technology and its implications for business, society, and politics. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming websites such as Apple Podcasts. We also hope you'll get in touch with us through either Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel, Twitter at Carol_Castiel, or by sending us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. And now back to our special guest, Mark Bryan. He's Senior Foresight Consultant at the Future Today Institute. So Mark, let's turn now to how many international companies, particularly here in the United States, the corporate world is trying to pivot from manufacturing in China and go to other more friendly nations. How do you see this trend evolving?
So there's a term called, it's the phrase that everybody's using right now, it's decoupling from China. I think it's something that has been going on for a while now, where companies were realizing that they wanted to start pivoting their manufacturing and productions away from China for stability purposes, and also just for maybe some nationalistic tendencies, trying to be more insular with where they're producing things, also with the disruption due to the global supply chain. So we're seeing some major phone producers are actually shifting their production of some of their phones to other countries that are closer to home, closer to China. This is starting to parlay into that nearshoring trend, where companies and businesses are trying to find ways to put their production facilities in places that would be less volatile, less conflict potential. This is also something that people at the World Trade Organization and the World Economic Forum are talking about in terms of reglobalization, where what they are wanting to do is to encourage people who are looking to reshore and nearshore be able to pivot to more developing countries, countries that might be able to provide those production and manufacturing closer to home. So I think, you know, we're going to continue to see companies evaluate production in China, continue to evaluate where they want their goods and materials to come from. And especially with the war in Ukraine and Russia, and that becoming, again, still a disruptor to the supply chain.
With regard to nearshoring, and it's a phrase that I'm not sure if our Treasury Secretary invented it, but nonetheless, Janet Yellen spoke of friendshoring. And of course, that is within the context of this turmoil, the war in Ukraine perpetrated by Russia. And she says that our objective should be to achieve free but secure trade. We can't allow countries to use their market position in key raw materials, i.e. gas and oil, technologies or products, to have the power to disrupt our economy or exercise unwanted geopolitical leverage. That sounds very much like she's speaking of Russia in particular, and of course, China. So what is your sense of so-called friendshoring, trying to work with a number of trusted countries so we can continue to securely extend market access and lower our risks?
Well, yes, friendshoring is definitely in the same realm. So there's nearshoring, which is moving production and manufacturing, even your labor. So technology is oftentimes outsourced to other countries for digital strategies and programming and everything. And so there's nearshoring in other countries that are nearby that, again, provides some more stability. There's friendshoring to countries that you are obviously friendly with. And there's reshoring, which is obviously all the same thing. So they're all kind of bundled together. What I think is going to be really interesting to watch is how long the Russia-Ukraine war goes on for and what it will mean for the supply chain. Because what's happened is that this land, sea, and air transportation methods, you know, the airspace has become a place we can't use over the war. Different shipping routes have had to change due to war, even where they're not even to be able to use at all. And so it's caused a lot of disruption. Again, this is all pushing people to want to nearshore and reshore. Ironically, so there's a nearshoring index called Savills, and it actually measures nearshoring potential. And number one at the top of the list is Vietnam. And we're seeing some of those phone companies I mentioned reshoring, nearshoring to Vietnam, which could have potential conflicts with China in the future. But ironically, Ukraine was number two on that list, which is also ironic because they were also one of the top tech job suppliers for the world, too. So if companies were looking for tech workers outside of the country, Ukraine was also one of those countries that people could look to. So that might indicate in the future that when the war is over, that might be a way that they can redevelop their country. I would also say that a lot of companies are looking to South America and Central America. Right now, there is a huge boom in Mexico of reshoring for the United States, especially along the Texas border. We're seeing, again, a lot of tech talent being invested in there. We are also seeing a lot of tech talent in Brazil being called upon by businesses. Some of that's due to the time zones. So one of the other reasons people are going to this nearshoring, reshoring, friendshoring is because they're trying to find tech talent within their same time zone so that they can be working synchronously versus more asynchronously. So I think this is going to continue to go or become a trend in 2023. I also think it'll become more of a trend as we're seeing things like you had alluded to in our intro, the weaponizing of resources, where we have countries like Russia who alleged that they had a disruption to their Nord Stream 1 pipeline that sends gas into Germany. And Germany has known for a long time that they have had an over-dependency on resources from Russia, and they were warned about it. And now there is an alleged issue with the pipeline, and it hasn't been turned back on, even though they've said that they had multiple deadlines to be turned back on. So right now, we're seeing them pivot to new fuel sources. They're making new agreements with France. So part of it is a weaponization, but then part of it is also forcing people to pivot to new strategies, which might end up being for the better when it comes from a sustainability and environment standpoint.
Technology and its use in our world changing constantly. What kind of skills and certifications do you see will be needed by tech industries, tech businesses, just regular businesses in the future? The workforce is definitely changing, and they'll need the education to keep up with the demand.
Absolutely. A lot of people are afraid of technology. I think that that might be one of the good things that came from the pandemic, people becoming more friendly with technology or just technology aware. So one of the biggest skill sets that I see needing out there is the VR training content development. We're seeing this a lot within manufacturing, but within other industries too, where they are showing that when they have training that is done through virtual reality or MR mixed reality, people are actually retaining the information faster. This means that they can train them on any number of situations. There are some airline companies that are training their future workers in order to know how to do maintenance rather than a live site, you know, so maybe at an airport virtually. That's a safety measure that allows people to be able to learn something in a real-time situation, but without the potential for harm. Not negating the need for still training to happen in those situations, but it's an opportunity. I also think that we're starting to see many more automation certifications come about, where we've got an aging transportation industry, and a lot of people are trying to figure out where to pivot too, especially with the rise of autonomous vehicles and autonomous semis and trucking. We've got autonomous ships and planes now too. So I think as a opportunity for even reskilling, that could be an area where they already know the transportation industry, but giving them new tools for automation training might make them be able to have a next stage of life when it comes to their work life.
And Mark, what about the area of microblogging? Of course, with Twitter now, some have objected to Elon Musk's taking over of that platform, saying that, you know, it's spreading more falsehoods. There's a rise in hate speech since he took over, etc. And some people are trying to go to other platforms such as Mastodon. There's Hive Social and Post. These are all new to me, but maybe you could talk about that particular trend.
It's been very interesting to watch. It's almost like we're seeing a fragmentation of some social media platforms to become much more smaller or to become smaller and to become much more focused. And so Twitter is the main one that's at the top of everybody's mind right now. What's really interesting is I was watching a talk the other day that talked about somebody who worked at Twitter recently was saying that maybe one of the reasons that they're seeing this lean towards the right with Twitter is because it's actually been proven that Twitter actually leans more to the right. A lot of what's put out on Twitter is shown to be more right-facing. And so the speaker was talking about how this might be how Elon Musk is trying to shore up his base of users, especially against things like Truth Social. So what Mastodon is it's another option. I wouldn't go so far to say it's the option, but I think it's another option that people are exploring. So it's actually a decentralized social media platform, meaning that rather than being hosted by a central business or even some central servers, there are multiple servers, what they call instances. So Mastodon provides open source code so that anybody can start their own instance or their own server, really, which is the benefit of it. So that way it really isn't meant to be monetized. It's not meant to be controlled by the self-interest of one individual. And so this is something that where people can see it as a way to maybe find freedom to try out different instances. Now you can go and join. And when you join, you get to choose a server platform or instance platform. Some of them are based around common topics like the environment or space or data technology. But that doesn't mean that's all you see. You can see other people on Mastodon. You can follow other people on Mastodon, just as similar to Twitter. So a lot of similarities to it. But there's no algorithms that are really meant to keep you scrolling. And again, it's not meant to monetize you. What's really intriguing to me about this is right now, there are studies out that show that people trust social media more than some news media outlets. Although local news is still dominating with one of the more predominant means of trusted news, but people are going to social media for their news, for data. I think it's something like 37%, 39% of Gen Z, that's their primary news media resource for daily place where they go. One of the things that was interesting to watch during the midterm elections in the United States in 2022 was this, where people were going for their information. And if you were, I think it was 40 or older, you went to more traditional news media outlets. And if you were obviously 39 or younger, you went to social media. And the rise of this is interesting to watch because what some elected officials are saying, it's because of the pace and the issue with the pace of responding to these tweets, these posts, these reels that go viral a lot faster than elected officials or even news media outlets have the time to be able to respond, because checking facts takes time. And so I think one of the things that we could be looking for social media in the future globally is this idea that maybe what we need to do is figure out how the local news media and social media link up together. Maybe it's done in this decentralized platform like Mastodon that allows people to feel like they have a choice in where their content comes from. The last thing that I wanted to add to that was just there are things like Project Liberty. So Frank McCourt, the McCourt Institute, is looking at blockchain technology that's looking to actually decentralize the entire internet. Their premise is that they want to build ethics into code so that we can have a trusted internet source, trusted social media. And it's really about the premise of taking our data back. So social media news outlets use data for monetization purposes. We don't see any of that monetization, at least I don't see any of that monetization. So this whole idea of Project Liberty is about making sure that our data works for us and not the other way around. And that if we're engaging with a website, with an app, with some kind of social media platform, they have to agree to our terms versus we have to agree to the terms and conditions by the social media platforms.
I just wanted to ask you or make a comment about how younger people, Gen Z, maybe are going to social media. I just don't understand, because I thought social media, whether Facebook, Twitter, or whatever, TikTok, I guess, they're platforms. So news media, New York Times, LA Times, they appear and they have editors. So I don't know, you know, what kind of propaganda or disinformation is floating around. And I think part of it is that people who are using these platforms have to be educated and know what they're reading and make sure whose byline is it. Has it been edited?
One thing that I saw, there was an article put out about how Finland might be a way to show how we can rebuild trust in our democracy, because they build in classes for spotting misinformation. They actually do programs in art classes that are to create ads. And then they talk about how some of the ads may not live up to the hype that they put together. So I agree with you, Carol. I think there is an education issue that's missing when it comes to being able to spot news media sources and misinformation. I think also right now we unfortunately live in a world where celebrities are thought of as experts. And so a person on TikTok, a person on any other social media platform who maybe has thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of followers is seen as an expert over the people who are actually doing the research to say what is true and what is not.
As we close, Mark Bryan, I'd like you to address, if you're willing to, cryptocurrency. It's just a term we're hearing more and more. And of course, toward the end of 2022, this gentleman, Sam Bankman-Fried, who ran FTX, a cryptocurrency exchange, was indicted by the Securities and Exchange Commission. He engaged in a scheme to defraud customers of his FTX by misappropriating their deposits. Billions of dollars were lost. This was a huge and, of course, remains a scandal. So what does this say about cryptocurrency, its viability as an investment?
I think it's still the same question that people should be asking themselves if they want to look into it. What is your risk tolerance? Because there are people on both sides where they're using this as the example to say, see, cryptocurrency can't work. But there are also people who are saying, well, this is just one example, one bad example, where what really went wrong was the business, not the actual cryptocurrency itself. So in my opinion, what I've been hearing and seeing, people are talking about that this will hopefully catapult cryptocurrency to become much more transparent, you know, with their transactions becoming much more regulated, hopefully having government step in, as well as being able to hopefully maybe push one of the platforms ahead, making them, whether that's Ethereum or one of the other top contenders, to become the primary, or even maybe there's a primary and secondary, because right now there aren't a lot of cryptocurrencies out there, and a lot of them don't have any backing to them. And so they are poor investments. The hard part is doing your due diligence to figure out which one would be the right to invest in, and to know if you're going to hit another situation like FTX with their FTT cryptocurrency. You know, again, the thing that made it collapse was basically what happens when you have a run on a bank where you lose faith in the institution and everybody goes to claim their money. Unfortunately, in this instance, what they found is that the money wasn't there. And so that will hurt cryptocurrency, yes, but I think it's just going to hopefully, again, push for stronger regulations and making people want to be more assured and transparent with what cryptocurrency they should invest in.
And before we close, Mark Bryan, anything you would like to add with regard to trends in 2023, building upon, you know, what you talked about last year?
I think there's a great amount of opportunity from a sustainability standpoint, especially within the built environment. There are tons of new materials that are being created every day, whether it's from algae. You know, we're seeing algae being put into facades that can generate energy. We're seeing modular construction opening up opportunities for retrofitting spaces without waste. We're seeing generative design where buildings are using solar panels to generate electricity, but then instead of using that to help with the electric bill, they're using that to provide opportunities for free Wi-Fi for the neighborhoods that they're going into. So I think sustainability is one area that I think we're still going to see a lot more happen, especially with our energy productions and maybe even buildings going more and more off-grid. I think it'll be very interesting to watch to see what happens globally with unions. You know, we're seeing strikes happen all over the world. And I think that is due to a lack of recognition of workers, whether that's wages or if it's a railway strike, whether that's due to just wanting simple things like time off. And again, I think watching how companies plan and respond their ESG policies to be as transparent as possible will be measures that people are going to be looking to in order to know if they want to buy a product from them, if they want to be an employee from them. So if you're talking about attraction and retention, ESG policies are going to be another way to maybe help bring people on board.
If you wouldn't mind, ESG is an acronym for
environmental, social, and corporate governance. So basically, it's what is a company's policy stance or how they act when it comes to the environment, when it comes to social issues, and within their own internal corporate governing of their business.
That was Mark Bryan. He's Senior Foresight Consultant at the Future Today Institute. Mark, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your terrific insights with us.
My pleasure. Again, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks also to my colleague, Rick Pantaleo, host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA and VOA's Science in a Minute. That's all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. This is Carol Castiel reminding you to join us once again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.